good morning, everyone, from the Land of Enchantment. Welcome to the other side of midnight, that magic time between dusk and dawn, where the things that in daytime we kind of hurry on by and never even give a second glance. At this time of night, when we have the time, we can focus on details, evidence, and assemble another picture. Well, anyway, that's what we're going to do this morning, and our subject, as you know, if you have read theothersideofmidnight.com, is a very interesting subject, which kind of interweaves and overlaps with some of the things that I've been looking at for years, and that is Scientology. So we're going to kind of get into the nuts and bolts of Scientology and some of the remarkable cosmic backdrop that Scientology purports to represent, and against the backdrop of the real stuff that NASA is now showing us. Anyway, this should be a kind of an interesting morning. Before we go further, I do want to take a moment and acknowledge, again, we have a major American city in turmoil tonight, Charlotte, North Carolina, where I've been, by the way, many, many times. Beautiful city, gorgeous city, great, great folks, great people. But again, they're on the knife edge of this incredible social discontent, which is manifesting itself everywhere in the landscape, including the overreach and the overreaction of officials, and then the lack of transparency. I mean, the major thing that seems to be going on in Charlotte is there's a dash cam video purportedly of this murder, this killing. Don't want to call it a murder. And they're not showing it. Now, if it was a sculptory, why not show it? If it shows what the family is claiming, why not show it? In other words, in a democracy, the social media is so outstripped the bureaucratic responses to these kind of crises, because if there had been full transparency in the beginning, one person tonight would not be on life support clinging to life because another individual shot him during this prolonged protest. So transparency, government transparency, that's what this is all about. That's what this whole campaign is all about. I mean, the polarization is extraordinary. Okay, if you go to theothersideofmidnight.com, click on Radio with Pictures, and then just scroll down. Under my items, you'll see another one. Item number one, Elizabeth Warren. I want you to take a look at this. Elizabeth Warren took apart the CEO of Wells Fargo in a way that I have never seen a public official since maybe the McCarthy era taken apart by another public official. And again, you say Wells Fargo is a private business. Not really, when they're too big to fail, when society and civilization rests on their integrity. You got to kind of go and listen to what Elizabeth is saying. And there will be reasons next week. We're going to talk more about Elizabeth Warren, but moving on. Item number three tonight, here's a wonderful story. The man, the voice, the stories. Vin Scully is retiring. The voice of baseball, 67 years narrating, championing the Dodgers. Vin, I mean, it's an incredible story of professionalism. Take a look, kind of review his career. The article basically says there can never be anyone like him again, and I kind of agree. Okay, item number four. Now, this is not me. This is M. M keeps telling me this story is important. We now have the New York Post shocking cover. Jennifer Aniston gets last. I mean, come on, folks. This is kind of like the campaign itself. Now, number five is kind of in keeping with what we do over here. This afternoon in New York, there was a very mysterious, very big boom heard in several boroughs. And nobody knows what it was. The FAA said initially it was F-22s. That turned out not to be true for a whole bunch of reasons. So no one really knows what was going on in New York. But in an era of terrorism, when anyone can purloin and have access to major energies, everyone is kind of on the edge right now. Anyway, we will come back with my guest of the morning. You're on the other side of midnight. Don't go away. We shall return. Writing's on the wall.
Deep.
And welcome back to a very chilly land of enchantment, New Mexico, this morning. It's also rainy. It's clammy and rainy and jagged lightning thunderstorms. And frankly, about an hour ago, I didn't know whether to be on the air because when they take out the power, of course, nothing can happen, but we're all fine. My guest this morning, and we're going to focus on this very interesting subject, which has all kinds of tendrils and roots that not much has been discussed recently, so we're going to try to get into some of those things, with Tony Ortega. Now, Tony is the editor of The Underground Bunker, which bills itself as the only website in the world that has a journalist covering Scientology as a daily beat. Tony's been writing about Scientology now for more than 20 years and worked at numerous publications, including The Village Voice in New York, where he was the editor-in-chief from 2007 to 2012. Last year, Tony published The Unbreakable Miss Lovely, a book that tells the full story of Paulette Cooper, one of the first journalists to expose Scientology, who nearly paid for it with her life. And we have a cover shot of the book at the bottom of Tony's bio. If you click on the link, which I didn't think to do, it takes you where you can find the book and read about it and even get a copy. So without further ado, let me welcome to my program this morning, to the other side of midnight, Tony Ortega. Tony, welcome.
Hey, Richard. Thank you for having me on.
We got to start this morning by kind of going way back in time. Bring out the Wayback Machine. Why don't we tell folks, A, what the hell is Scientology and its remarkable, amazing desert's beginnings in the southern climes of Southern California?
Well, you bet. Sure. L. Ron Hubbard started all this trouble with a book in 1950 called Dianetics. And I always like to point out that Dianetics has a very interesting subtitle. It is The Modern Science of Mental Health. This did not start out as a church or a religion. L. Ron Hubbard claimed that he had the first scientific approach to the nature of the human mind.
Hang on. Who was L. Ron Hubbard? Again, we're in 160 countries, and there's an awful lot of millennials, right. And L. Ron Hubbard may be more like Methuselah to some people.
L. Ron Hubbard is a really fascinating guy. He lived a fascinating life. In the 30s, he was a pulp fiction writer.
Science fiction.
Well, no, everything. Adventure stories, westerns, women's magazines. He wrote everything. And for a penny a word, back when that was the going rate, he actually came to science fiction later. He had written in a number of different genres, but it's for science fiction that he's most well known. And after the war, he was a lieutenant in the Navy in World War II. His fiction career had stalled somewhat, and he switched to this thing that he called Dianetics. And he was very fortunate that his editor at Astounding Stories really got into it and helped promote the heck out of it. So that when his book came out in May 1950, it got perhaps the best push it possibly could have, and it really caught fire. People were intrigued by this idea that this person who really had no background in, psychology or anything, was suddenly claiming he had suddenly figured out how the human mind works. And what Dianetics proposed
now,
was...
Hang on. Why would the 1950s culture, which was so authority-driven, remember what they did to Velikovsky? Why would they follow a guy named L. Ron Hubbard, who'd basically written for Boy's Adventure and, as you said, had been in the Navy but had zero medical background? Why did he suddenly take off? Who was pushing him?
Well, his timing was perfect, because you had a whole generation who had come home from the war and had really had their horizons expanded by that experience and were looking for new things. And also, I think what people forget is it was really the beginning of the rise of the self-help movement. And he was right there on the scene. And what he proposed...
So wait, you mean he was kind of like ahead of Tony Robbins?
Oh, absolutely.
But in that same genre, here's what's wrong with you. Here's how I can fix you, or with your help, fix yourself, that kind of thing.
Well, he had such an intriguing idea that people really caught on to. And the idea was this: that you're a 40-year-old adult or a 50-year-old adult, and you have various problems in your life that you've always dealt with. Hubbard tells you that what you're not seeing about yourself is that there were traumas early in your life that are holding you back. And what you need to do is go back and find those traumas. He called them engrams. And he had a kind of counseling that would remove them. And what was most intriguing was he said the most important of those traumas occurred while you were in your mother's womb. And he believed in something called prenatal memories. And if
Hang on, I'm confused here. Is he talking about just impressions from the 9 months spent running around with mom, or was he talking reincarnation?
No, that came later, Richard. In Dianetics, in Dianetics, he's simply talking about your time as sperm, egg, or zygote. And it's I've read Dianetics page of cover to cover. I blogged it at my website. And what he was proposing was that he believed that the human mind had two halves. One was an analytical mind that was a perfectly recording computer, perfect working instrument, but that it was you had this other half of your mind that took over during a trauma when you were knocked out. And he called that the reactive mind. And the reactive mind would absorb things that happened to you, store them away, and then they would be restimulated later by other phenomena. So the examples he tended to use, he used them over and over again in the book, was dad getting rough with mom when she was pregnant. I mean, there's just example after example of mom and dad having rough sex or dad screaming at mom and the fetus absorbing that. And so what you need to do is those words that your dad shouted at your mother have been stored away in the reactive mind and they affect your later life. And so you need to go back into the womb. Remember what happened to you when you were only a two-week-old zygote and recover that memory. And if you saw the movie The Master, they actually did a pretty good job showing people trying to do this in the early 50s when this became popular briefly. And Hubbard believed that if you could remember what happened to you as a two-week-old fetus and then do – you know, his idea of counseling was – just remember it and talk it out with another person called an auditor. Between those two people and just this one book, you could clear away the impact of all those early memories and clear away the reactive mind and become something he called a clear. And he promised fairly superhuman powers right off the bat. If you were clear, if you no longer had that reactive mind, you would have total recall, you would be impervious to illness. He really believed that we were all sort of like superhumans being held down by these memories. So it was a very popular idea, and for about a year, it really caught on, and there were clubs formed around the country. He started a couple of foundations. Money started pouring in for lectures and that kind of thing, and then it all kind of crashed in the next year. In 1951, the foundations were bankrupt. He was in a lot of trouble. His marriage was falling apart. He regrouped in 1952 in Phoenix, and he had lost the use of the word Dianetics in bankruptcy, and so he came up with this new word, Scientology. And by that time, some of the people that were following him weren't satisfied to go back just to the womb. They wanted to go back farther, and that's where the idea of this past lives came from. And
when you say they wanted to go back, I remember, I mean, I'm kind of old enough to remember some of this. There was a big story, and again, this is before social media, when going viral wasn't even a kind of a concept, but it went viral, the search for Bridie Murphy.
Yeah.
And that hit like Reader's Digest and everything. And so in that milieu, did some of the Dianetics people say, wait a minute, why can't we go back beyond the zygote?
Right, and the Master, again, not the greatest movie, but it's dramatizing this period where some of the people are saying, listen, if we can go back to the womb, why don't we go back to, you know, much farther, to previous lifetimes? And other people who, remember, were drawn to this because the book said the modern science of mental health said this isn't science, this is fantasy. Mm-hmm. And so he had kind of a real struggle going on between some of his followers, which is dramatized in that movie. But by 52, Hubbard himself had adopted this idea that, yeah, you're not just going to go back to the womb. You have lived countless times previously, and I'm going to help you remember the traumas, not just that, you know, happened between mom and dad, but traumas that happened to you millions of years ago on other planets. And that's what Scientology is it's called auditing. It's a form of counseling. The auditor is just asking you questions about yourself, trying to help you remember some traumatic incident that happened to you tens of thousands of years ago, millions of years ago, billions of years ago. Ultimately, Hubbard came up with a cosmology which says that the universe is quadrillions of years old, and that that each of us is an immortal being called a Thetan, and it was Thetans that created the universe. And so you're not just trying to recover your superhuman abilities, but the abilities to be this universe-creating immortal creature.
You'll be back to being a god.
Exactly. That's what people need to understand. There's no god in Scientology. You are trying to recover your own godlike abilities. And that's what you spend years and years in increasingly expensive classes hoping to attain.
So is this what Tom Cruise is really searching for?
Yeah, he's at the top. He's gone through what they call it, the bridge to total freedom, and it starts out with classes that might only cost you $50. But by the time you get up to the upper level courses, remember I mentioned that the first goal was clear. By the 60s, that was only an intermediate goal, and you were going on to higher levels called operating Thetan levels, or OT. And currently the top OT level is OT8. And I don't think Tom has ever finished that. He did finish OT7, but I don't know that he's ever finished OT8. But to get to those upper level courses, when you get to the upper OT levels, you're talking counseling that costs $800 or $900 an hour.
Okay.
To help you remember these traumatic incidents billions of years ago. And it's at OT3 that you learn that while you're a Thetan, it turns out there are hundreds or thousands of other Thetans that are attached to you. They're called body Thetans. And you need to remove them from yourself. And so from OT4 to OT7, you're spending hundreds of dollars an hour to chase away these excess body Thetans. And this is, Richard, this is all well established in documents. We have price lists. Documents that have been entered in court. Every upper-level Scientologist that has left the organization and has talked to me confirms that this is what they do. And all of the top celebrities do it. Tom Cruise, John Travolta, Kirstie Alley, they are all spending hundreds of dollars an hour to chase away these excess, invisible alien souls that are attached to them.
Has anybody actually gone out and tried to chart famous people, particularly actors and actresses, and see if when they joined the church, there was a significant improvement in their career, in the number of parts, the quality of the acting? In other words, is there any correlation with their lives with this church? And again, you can say that and ask that about all churches, but we're talking about Scientology, so that's the question.
I don't know that anybody's done that in a systematic way. I think there's examples on both sides. I mean, You can trace actors who joined Scientology that will claim that it helped their career, but their careers were not that great. And whereas somebody like Jason Begay, for example, Jason was a gung-ho Scientologist who had a lot of TV and movie roles and left Scientology and was really the first Scientology actor to come out and say, really expose them and denounce them. And since then, his career has gone like skyrocketed. He's got his own series on NBC. So there's an example of somebody that did better after he left Scientology. Leah Remini is going through the same thing right now. Her career, I would say, was a little bit of an ebb when she left Scientology in 2013. And since then, she's much more visible. She's had a reality show. She's got another show coming up in January. So John Travolta will tell
John Travolta
you,
is my favorite Scientologist. Do you know why?
Why?
He's got his own 707.
Well, yeah. And he ascribes all of his success in life to L. Ron Hubbard.
Really?
Yes. That's why he doesn't leave. I know everyone thinks that he doesn't leave because they're blackmailing him because he's got all these secrets they keep track of. But I discount that because at this point, with all the lawsuits that have been filed against him by massage therapists, what more secrets can there be,
Well, that's one way of putting it. Okay, look, let's change tracks here for a second.
Sure.
You had a very interesting career in journalism before you became obsessed, and I'm obsessed, so I use the term among friends, we're both obsessed about separate things, and those things actually might cross. I'm going to get to that in a few minutes.
Sure.
But you started out in journalism. You were at the Village Voice, which is one of my icons. Tell me about journalism. Why? How is journalism, and this is not that much of a switch, folks, how has journalism changed from the time when we had incredible investigative reporting? I mean, you've been on this story on Scientology for, what, a generation? And nobody else, you know, with occasional little eruptions of celebrityism, nobody else really seems to care. So where is journalism in this saga?
Well, I think there are some very good journalists that cover Scientology. Lawrence Wright at The New Yorker, his book Going Clear was a terrific examination of Scientology, and he worked with Alex Gibney last year to do the documentary Going Clear, and I'm in it. I think there's been some really, really good journalism done on Scientology by very good journalists. Scientology made it very difficult for a lot of years to get stories done about Scientology. They you know, in 1991, Time magazine came out with a cover story about Scientology that really exposed them, and they fought back by suing Time for $416 million. Time won that lawsuit and had it dismissed, but not before they spent about $8 million defending themselves. So for a long time, there was a chill on the press about covering the subject, and except for people like Richard Leiby at the Washington Post or the guys at the Tampa Bay Times, it was really difficult to get a story out about them. And then the sort of the floodgates opened several years ago for a couple of reasons. First of all, because Tom Cruise started going more public about Scientology, and that kind of opened things up. And then in the mid-2000s, a number of top Scientology executives all left at the same time or within a few years of each other and decided to go public with what they knew. And that really opened the floodgates for a lot of coverage of what was really going on in Scientology. So believe me, there are TV shows right now being developed about Scientology and movies, and they still go through just a real avalanche of legal onslaught from Scientology. Scientology still, one of the things that's fascinating I find about Scientology is that they have to follow the playbook that L. Ron Hubbard left behind. And in the 60s, he wrote these rules out about, listen, we don't defend ourselves, we attack people. And they still do that. And that's partly what my book is about, is the way they went after a journalist named Paulette Cooper. But yeah, it's been very difficult at times to get stories out about Scientology. But right now, one of the things that one of the reasons why you're seeing so much about Scientology online, in movie theaters, is that people are fascinated by it. And I've talked to editors. They know that if they put a story about Scientology on their front page, it will be the most read story that day.
Are they interested in the concept, or are they interested in the celebrities?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think the fact that it's got some celebrities attached to it, the fact that they're secretive about what they do, and the fact that they have these, you know, pretty esoteric beliefs. You put those three things together, and it's an irresistible subject. And also the fact that they're known for being bullies and going after people that come out and speak out, and these amazing stories about confinement and imprisoning their own people and child labor. It's kind of amazing to think that's going on in the United States in the 21st century. So I think all those things make it a really interesting subject to people. And I've definitely, enjoyed that people just can't get enough of these stories.
Well, if it weren't for people like Cruise, who was so incredibly flamboyant, jumping on the couch, Oprah and all that, he kind of drew a focus on Scientology through the lens of Tom Cruise, which made it a fun, entertaining thing as opposed to a revealing, this is what the institution is thing.
Well, L. Ron Hubbard in 1955 issued something he called Project Celebrity. I mean, he understood that if they could get actors and actresses and other top famous people into the organization, that it would help promote it and make it seem less crazy. And so they have always gone after celebrities. And Tom Cruise was particularly valuable to them because he got involved in 1986, just a couple of months after Hubbard had died. And one of the
does the organization admit that Hubbard has now finally died?
Well,
because for a long time he was at sea, on some ship somewhere, some ocean.
Yeah, he was actually on a ranch in California when he died, and 3 days later at the Hollywood Palladium, they announced that he had voluntarily left his very healthy body in order to conduct research in an incorporeal state. I haven't met a Scientologist yet who didn't sort of like, yeah, we know that's not true. You know, they know he died, but they do expect him to come back, you know. But he died in January 1986, and then just a few months later, Tom Cruise started taking courses with his friend Mimi Rogers, who he married a year later. So, one of the things that's kind of remarkable is a group like this to survive its founder, and I think Tom Cruise helped them with that.
Hang on. Speaking of coming back, we have to take a short break here. We will be back with my guest of the morning, Tony Ortega. We're discussing L. Ron Hubbard and the mysteries of Scientology, and it's going to get a lot more mysterious before it becomes clear. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. Girl, I said with a smile, you don't have to love me yet, let's get high. Ah, yes. Crosby, Stills, Nash on this Thursday morning. Just hovering above 60 degrees, Patrick. But that gorgeous gibbous moon is up there, so if you can look above the clouds, there is moonlight on the other side. Okay, let's go back, Tony, to the nexus that I'm intrigued with, which is the connection between L. Ron Hubbard and a guy that some in this audience might be familiar with, and many will probably not be, a guy named Jack Parsons. Talk about that incredibly intertwining and what developed from that.
Yeah, it's a fascinating episode in Hubbard's life that the Church of Scientology really doesn't like to talk about.
Really? Hubbard...
Oh, no.
Oh,
no,
that's interesting.
Yeah. Hubbard had a kind of undistinguished experience in World War II, which he and the church lied about later. But he was in Los Angeles at the end of the war, and a mutual friend introduced him to Jack Parsons. Jack Parsons is a legendary figure. He was literally a rocket scientist. He was one of the founders of JPL. He was from a family with some
JPL,
money.
NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California.
And he had a house in Pasadena, a large house that was known for being a place for eccentrics. He would rent out the rooms only to other eccentrics, and he was an occultist. He was a real fan of a British occultist named Aleister Crowley. And
the most evil man in the world.
And a fascinating guy. I think there's a crater on the moon named after him. Jack's just there are wonderful books about him that people should read. So into this environment walks L. Ron Hubbard. And, you know, by this time, L. Ron Hubbard's this, got a lot of books to his credit or stories to his credit. He's a tall tale teller, and he just fits right in. In fact,
so this was kind of like a Western Hotel Algonquin.
Something like that, right. And Hubbard walks in and almost immediately steals Jack's girlfriend away, Sarah Northrup, which Jack apparently didn't mind. And they found that they both had this interest in the occult. And at one point...
And when you say occult, you're talking real heavy, heavy occult, calling up somebody from the other side, some other dimension to do your bidding, that kind of occult.
Jack was corresponding with Crowley in England and was informing him that they were using his ideas about sex magic rituals to call up forces. And the thing that they were trying to do, what Jack wanted to do that Crowley had theorized, was that he, using certain sex magic rituals, they could actually create something they called the Moon Child, and he was going to inseminate a woman and create this child that had the potential to become the Antichrist or something. I mean, just very bizarre stuff. And so here's Jack Parsons and L. Ron Hubbard in this house in Pasadena. And you know, we have eyewitness testimony from another person who lived in the house and said they would get up in these costumes and light candles and, you know, evoke spirits and all this. And then they would send reports to Crowley, and Crowley thought they were idiots. You know, I mean, eventually after, you know, trying these things, Hubbard and...
Wait, let me interrupt.
Yeah, yeah.
Why did Crowley think they were idiots? Come on, one guy was a rocket scientist. The other guy was a naval veteran. You know, why did he think they were crazy unless...
I think he didn't expect them to take those particular ideas seriously. You know, I have to admit, I'm not 100% sure, but he just did not think much of them and what they were doing. And ultimately, so they had these various rituals. And Lawrence Wright does a great job in his book, Going Clear, describing these things. And basically, Jack was having sex with this woman named Marjorie Cameron while Hubbard took notes, which was actually a metaphor for masturbation. It's a bizarre scene, Richard, and you should read Larry's description of it. But ultimately, the way that relationship ended was that Jack and Sarah, L. Ron Hubbard and his girlfriend Sarah proposed this idea. They would go to Florida, buy a boat, and sail it back. And the three of them would split the profits. And basically what ended up happening is Ron and Sarah just went to Florida with Jack's money and, you know, ripped him off. Mm. And Jack ended up suing them to get his money back. And they sort of never had anything to do with each other after that. But it's a very intriguing, brief interlude in Hubbard's life where he's living in Jack Parsons' house, engaging in these sex magic rituals. And, you know, look, I would just say, great. It's just an interesting part of his life. He's a writer. He should have experiences like that. But the Church of Scientology really doesn't like people talking about it. In fact, they invented a story claiming that actually what was happening was Hubbard was working for Naval Intelligence to infiltrate and ruin black magic in America. I mean, it's just a ridiculous cover story. he was just a young man, you know, sowing his wild oats and having a good time. And actually, he absorbed a lot of ideas from Crowley that you find in Scientology. And a couple of scholars, Hugh Urban at Ohio State University and John Atack in England, have done really excellent jobs just showing all the parallels between Crowley's work and Hubbard's work in Scientology. He just lifted a lot of those ideas. And again, that's another thing that the Church of Scientology does not like to discuss and denies, that they have anything to do with the occult. But it's right there. I mean, there's a lot of parallels between what Crowley said and what Hubbard ultimately put into Scientology.
You know, that nexus, that connection between those two guys always fascinated me because, and we'll get to this probably in the next hour with some detail, but if you look at what JPL, what NASA has actually found in the solar system, which we talk about regularly here, we're going to talk about it on another imaging panel this coming Saturday morning. Be here or be square. We're going to start back at the discovery of the face on Mars and move forward to what Curiosity is showing us. And then we're going to all talk about what does it mean. Tony, what we're finding out from NASA now is that everything that Hubbard has projected in his religion about us living previous lives in an incredible celestial environment where there were maybe millions of years of civilization, it's looking like it could be true. So then the question is, then the question is, was the connection to naval intelligence a cover story, or was he in fact part of a Navy investigation of things so much bigger than most people even think about, and it got encapsulated when he went kind of rogue and on his own to basically create a religion, which, I mean, one of his friends told me one time years ago, almost four decades ago, he says, Dick, we should, create a religion like Ron did.
Well, yeah, look, this guy also said there were freight trains on Venus, and, you know, implant stations on Mars. I mean, I don't know that there's much that L. Ron Hubbard ever proposed that's turned out to be true. And as far as naval intelligence, he was a naval intelligence officer at the beginning of the war, And what he did was he censored letters. I mean, there's no evidence that he did anything more high level than that. And we have combed through his military records, believe me.
Okay. By the way, let me stop you there. Everyone on Facebook and Twitter, remember, theothersideofmidnight.com, upper left-hand corner of the homepage, click on the Facebook or Twitter icons. You can join the conversation, and of course, I'm sure you will have some more intriguing questions as we get further into the morning, because this rabbit hole gets pretty deep. Sorry about that.
No problem. Yeah, I mean, the essential issue with Hubbard's, you know, sort of credibility is he did lead a fascinating life. He was a glider pilot in his 20s. He did serve in the military in both the Atlantic and the Pacific. He did, you know, meet fascinating people as a very young man. But, you know, he was a pulp fiction writer, and he was used to turning everything into a tall tale. And so by the time he had, you know, created Dianetics and then Scientology and had a lot of followers, he was telling these amazing tales about himself that just weren't true. Mm. And it's, you know, taken the work of some really excellent journalists like John Atack and Russell Miller and Lawrence Wright, and Janet Reitman, and now Steve Kinnane with a wonderful new book that came out this week, to really peel back the tall tales and get to what really happened. And, you know, Hubbard's a fascinating guy, there's no question. But what he was proposing, you know, was that when we die in this lifetime and the Thetan is released, you would be whisked away to Venus or Mars, where there are these implant stations being run by the fourth and fifth invader forces that have been here in the solar system for tens of thousands of years. And your memory would be wiped, and then you'd be put back in a baby on Earth to start a new life. And only Scientology and its expensive counseling allows you to give you the power to resist that between-life implanting and live lifetime to lifetime fully conscious of who you are. It's fast. It's fast. Believe me, I get it. I understand, especially in the 50s and 60s. Why this was just fascinating.
Well,
this is
what I want to get to, because how many members at the high point, at the high watermark, does Scientology have?
Yeah, and this is why it's important that some top-level executives came out about 10 years ago, is they had access to those enrollment documents. Okay. And they all tell me that the height of Scientology was about the year 1990, when they had about 100,000 people.
Okay. Let me stop you there.
Yeah.
We have a problem with Muslims, you know, in terms of not problem with Muslims per se, but a problem of perception of Muslims. And there are 1.5 billion of those people, right?
Right.
Then we got about 1 billion Catholics, and, you know, you look around the planet and all the – why are we focused on Scientology? What is the incredible public danger of 100,000 people back in 1990, 20 years ago? Why are we still talking about it?
Exactly. It's a great question, because – they've never had the millions that they claimed. And now I would say, based on recent executives who've left, that they're down to about 20,000 people around the country. This thing is tiny.
So why are we doing a show, Tony? Why have you devoted your life to this? I mean, it's almost like you're chained to a typewriter. For folks who don't know what a typewriter was, it was a very bad thing to be chained to.
No, it's always gotten much more attention and much more press than it probably deserves. And it's because of the celebrities, and it's because of the bullying. It's the way this organization runs roughshod over the American court system. It is fascinating. I mean, you know, why does this group still have tax-exempt status? Why does it have billions of dollars? No question, it commands much more
press
attention
than it
probably deserves.
When M proposed that we do something with you on this, I thought, okay, what's the angle that's relevant now to the 21st century? And the one angle I see is that L. Ron Hubbard in his day was as successful at convincing people of impossible things before breakfast as Donald Trump is now.
You know,
I see an incredible parallel between these two guys.
It's funny, because it comes up again and again. People are really seeing a lot of Hubbard and Trump. And I wrote a story about this not long ago at the website, because, yes, we see people in the press, you know, repeatedly saying, look at the way Donald Trump talks and the effect he has on people. Look at the way, you know, his people act. it reminds them of L. Ron Hubbard and reminds them of Scientology. And I said, that may be true, but I really haven't found any real connections between Donald Trump and Scientology, only very tenuous ones. It's Hillary Clinton who has the Scientology baggage. I mean, if she, you know,
You've got to tell us that story. Well, was Hillary Clinton actually in the, okay.
No, what I'm saying is there has never been a friendlier White House to the Church of Scientology than Bill Clinton's. All right. And not only was it Bill Clinton who signed off on their tax exempt status in 1993, but his State Department really went to bat for Scientology when it came to Germany, where they were basically trying to ban it. And it was, you know, they charmed Bill with the use of Tom Cruise and John Travolta. Now, I don't know. I tried to find this out and the campaign won't respond to me. I don't know if Hillary feels the same way as Bill did. I mean, this is if she becomes president, right? This is one of the things we're all going to learn is how much of her policy is going to be like.
Well,
Bill's,
wait. Do you know anything about something called the Rockefeller Initiative during the Clinton administration?
Tell me.
Occupying the central interesting lives of both Bill and Hillary on a big ranch out in Wyoming, run by Lawrence Rockefeller. Lawrence Rockefeller, during the entire 8 years of Bill's administration, tried to get him to do in every way possible to disclose the UFO reality. And when Hillary became candidate in New Hampshire in Conway for an editorial board of the local Conway newspaper, she said she is going to open Area 51. She's going to investigate UFOs. She's going to find out if there's anything to this.
I remember that.
And Podesta, her campaign manager, has several venues, including CNN and Fox and whatever, reiterated this again and again and again. So Hillary is setting herself up as the first candidate in history to basically avow publicly an interest in extraterrestrial realities and to get to the bottom of a long-standing mystery, which overlaps an awful lot with L. Ron Hubbard and his philosophy.
Well, and, you know, if she becomes president, I will be very interested to see if, you know, Scientology benefits from that. I have a feeling, I mean, most of the Scientologists that I know tend to be Trump supporters, but I think the Church of Scientology would probably benefit more if Hillary becomes president. And so, again, that was a story I wrote. I understand why people compare Trump and Hubbard, but it's the Clinton White House that was really beneficial to the Church of Scientology.
Now, when you say beneficial, how did it help it materially? And because we're going to talk about Scientology in a very negative light, there's an awful lot of people who are quitting and telling us amazing stories of literal servitude and almost imprisonment. I want to get to that because, again, it seems to be part of this mystique, part of this philosophical vortex that swirls around this ideology. That's what I'm intrigued with. Where does this ideology come from that has a very, very dark side, kind of like a lot of the things that Trump has been doing and saying that have a very, very dark side? Is there a resonance there with a certain part of the human condition?
Well, I, if you want to understand why Scientology developed the way it did and became so ruthless and ended up abusing people, I really recommend this new book that just came out by Steve Kinnane. It's called Fair Game, and he's an Australian journalist living in England, and the book looks at Scientology in Australia specifically, but I really recommend it because it gives you a whole insight about all of Scientology and that it was an investigation done by the Australian government was the first to investigate Scientology.
And, what, you mean of all global governments, that was the first official investigation?
No, let me correct myself on that, Richard. The FDA had actually begun investigating Scientology in the 50s, but
this is our Food and Drug Administration.
Yeah, because of the health claims being made.
Right.
But in Australia, they had the first that actually resulted in a ban. They tried to ban a Scientology in the state of Victoria, but Steve Kinnane makes the argument that it was reacting to Australia's investigations that caused Hubbard to become so sort of clamped down on things and become very ruthless with his own people. And in the 60s, he just created all these rules. I also think it was because he hated breakaway groups. You know, if Scientology really were a science and you know, this was some discovery that Hubbard made, well, then, you know, the nature of science is that other people could replicate the results.
Mm.
And so people would break away from Hubbard and say, listen, we've got the knowledge. We understand how this works. We're going to do it on our own. And that drove him crazy. Now, the cynic would say it was because Hubbard was missing out on their income, right? But for whatever reason, he created an elaborate set of rules in the 50s and 60s that he called, apparently with a straight face, ethics. And if ethics came after you, you were in big, big trouble. And Steve Kinney makes the case that ethics became as ruthless as it was in part because of what was happening
so
in Australia.
So he created an inquisition in his church like the Catholic Church created centuries before. What were some of the rules?
Well, Scientology, I mean, basically you have to be completely loyal to Scientology. And you have to give up any kind of privacy about your personal life. They use this thing called the E-meter, which they think helps them in counseling. But they also use the E-meter as an interrogation device. And Scientologists believe...
Kind of like what, a lie detector?
It's, you know, a lie detector has measures several different things. This only measures one of them, and that's skin galvanism. It's a skin galvanometer. And I would, you know, you talk to an electrical engineer, he'll tell you that it doesn't measure much, you know. But Scientologists believe that it's literally... They call it measuring the mass of your thoughts, and that that you cannot hold a secret that the machine won't figure out. And I think that's an exaggeration, but that doesn't matter. What matters is they believe it. And so
perception.
when they're holding the sensors for this machine, they believe they can't hold back a secret, so they spill their guts.
Well, you know who invented that idea first, don't you? The Catholic Church again, which I used to be a proud member of.
Yeah, I mean, I understand what you're making the parallel with confession, but with confession, you're talking to a priest who's not writing anything down. In Scientology, you're hooked up to this machine, you're spilling your guts, they're writing it all down, and then they pass that folder around. And this folder grows and grows and grows, and Scientologists know that if they later leave and actually say something critical of the church, those secrets that you divulge suddenly show up in anonymous websites somewhere.
Well, websites now. Back when it was just letters, what'd they do? Send letters to the editor or something?
Well, they were ruthless. They would send it to your boss. You know, they would send it to your loved one. I mean,
again, for such a tiny organization, why is everybody scared to death? I mean, somebody said when they heard I was going to do the show, they said, "Oh, be careful what you ask." It's like, why?
Well,
what gives these people such power? I'm asking a really deep question, Tony, because they have far more influence, public visibility, and connection to stuff than an organization of their minuscule size in this culture should have, unless the connection with Jack Parsons and what we're now finding in the solar system actually has something going for it.
Well, I would say that it's a lot more quotidian than that, and it's not so much the celestial bodies, it's private investigators. Okay, this is what they spend endless money on, and this is... You know, let me segue into my book. My book is called The Unbreakable Miss Lovely, and it's about one particular campaign. A journalist named Paulette Cooper wrote one of the first books about Scientology, and they tried to destroy her life because of it. And they used all these private investigators and operatives. They were running elaborate operations to destroy her life from 1969 to 1985. I mean, this is why Scientology got the reputation that it did, is that they're so ruthless and single-minded about destroying people that speak out about it. And that's why it doesn't surprise me that you had friends saying, "Oh, you want to stay away from that subject." They earned that reputation, okay? Because they have destroyed so many lives for people who just spoke out, who just said, "Listen, I was part of this group. They took all my money, they split my family apart." Oh, that's it. They're on you, you know? And they just are so single-minded about it, and they have spent years and years doing that. And one of the things that Paulette and I set out to do was, you know, enough time has passed. We actually found some of the people that had run some of these operations against her, and so we get the kind of perspective of the other side, and we learned some surprising things. We learned about operations run against her she wasn't even aware of. I think that's, you know, where Scientology gets a bigger reputation than maybe it deserves, because they're so single-minded about these retaliation campaigns.
Okay, I want to wait till get into Ms. Cooper's story till after the top of the hour, so we have kind of an uninterrupted runway. I'll be able to talk this morning. We're still in Mercury retrograde, folks, so keep that in mind. But let me talk about a couple of other things here. What is knowledgeism?
I don't know that in relation to Scientology.
That's not a technical term associated with the church?
Well, it might be an offshoot. There's so many. I mean, people have been leaving Scientology and creating their own groups.
Okay, so we have a fractalization of the what Hubbard was doing. See, again, Hubbard, it's like before he didn't. Did he use much television to sell Dianetics and Scientology? Because I don't remember seeing commercials for Scientology.
In fact, that's how they reached that greatest extent in 1990 was in the 80s. If you remember, they had a very, very successful television campaign. I know the person that ran it. His name is Jefferson Hawkins. He was their marketing director in those years. And he came up with this very effective television ad. And it was just a black screen. And it would come up with some text saying, "How do I improve my marriage? Page 150. How do I get a better job? Page 222. And then this volcano would come on the screen.
Oh, I know. I remember that one.
Yes. And it was the cover of Dianetics.
The cover of that. It's that weird, bizarrely colored, like greens and reds. And it was
a fabulously successful advertising campaign. And it helped them sell so many books. And that's what led to growing to 100,000 by the year 1990. But it's all been downhill since then.
I mean, the Planetary Society has over 100,000, and they don't have any sexy commercials. Okay, so, all right, we've only got a couple of minutes here before we go to the break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about the person you profiled, because apparently she really did pay awful prices for trying to do her job.
Yeah, at one point she was framed for a felony that she had her facing 15 years in federal prison. And that was in 1973. She was indicted for that. And it wasn't until the FBI raided Scientology 4 years later in 1977 that they discovered documents spelling out that she'd been framed by the Church of Scientology. Scientology had a very sophisticated spy organization called the Guardian's Office. And they put all of their efforts into trying to destroy her life. And
so wait a minute. They had basically an insurrection office, the Inquisition.
Yeah.
And then they had a KGB.
Exactly.
Wow. How can a private organization, a corporation, for God's sake, get away with this in the United States of America?
Richard, they had the largest infiltration of the U.S. federal government in history. It was called the Snow White program, and it ran from 1974 until they were finally raided in 1977. I mean, they were burglarizing and infiltrating federal government offices.
I'll tell you what, hold it there. We'll come back and talk about Snow White. What an interesting name.
Yeah.
And then the journalist who tried to break this, expose it. I mean, to me, my perception of Scientology came of age when I suddenly heard a news story about Scientologists putting a rattlesnake in someone's mailbox. True story. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, Tony Ortega. We're discussing L. Ron Hubbard and Scientology, and there's more to come. We shall return. Everybody, listen to
picking up the pieces of my sweet shattered dream. I wonder how the old folks are tonight.
Her name was Anna. And to the dulcet tones of Gordon Lightfoot? No Gordon Lightfoot. Well, we actually did a Gordon Lightfoot song on the B-side of our one single with the foregone conclusion released. Well, that's a long story. We'll surprise you some night. We'll actually find that record and I will play it for you. Yes, Gordon Lightfoot, well-known songstress and songer and singer, as well as everyone else. Okay, let's get back to Tony. Talk about Project Snowflake. Hello? Tony? Are you there? Hello, hello? Oh, this is terrible. This is terrible. Tony, unmute. Unmuting usually helps in these situations. There's a little thing there you can find. Oh, this is terrible. Oh, Tony's typing. He's here. He's unmuted. Okay, let's do this. Tell you what, let's have some more music, and I'm going to go and reconnect with Tony. And we'll be right back.
Every highway, I got to see you, my old friend. Every highway, you've seen better days. The morning after blue, from my head down to my shoes. away on you. Searching through the fragments of my dreams.
See, I should never make these kind of extemporaneous comments about music we're playing, because sometimes the music gods just want to hear the music and they say, to heck with the guest. Tony, welcome back. I don't know what electronic hiccup happened there, but we were going to talk about Project Snowflake, and when I talk about controversial things, weird things happen electronically on the show sometime.
It's the Snow White program.
Snow White, okay. Did I say what? Did I say Snowflake?
It's a fascinating, I deal with this in my book. You know, Hubbard basically had to leave the U.S. in the late 50s because the government was starting to investigate what he was doing. He went to England for several years.
No, wait, when you say the government, what part of the government? Justice Department, IRS?
The FDA was actually leading the investigation because of the health claims that were being made by Scientology.
You mean just the fact that they were saying that by going through this process, you'd get better? The FDA was upset about not taking a pill, not taking some substance, not whatever.
Well, see, back then in the 1950s, if you claimed you could cure disease, with the tricks of your mind or whatever, that got you in trouble. Today it gets you a TV series. But back then, the U.S. government actually took it seriously. And so he – and also taxes and things. And he decided to leave. He went to England in 1959, and he was really successful there for a few years. But then the British government started asking questions. In 1966, he actually went to Rhodesia and tried to take it over.
Wait. What?
Yeah.
How the hell did that work?
Not very well. It didn't work very well. And so then he came back, and he realized that if have kind of total control of his environment, he took to sea. He actually created a little private navy, and he ran Scientology from these three ships from 1967 all the way to 1975.
Oh, where the ocean thing came in.
He called himself the Commodore, and the young people he gathered around him, he called the Sea Organization. And in late 72 and through most of 73, he took a break because the ship was in dry dock. He hid out in an apartment in Queens, and he was kind of reflecting on where they were. They kept getting kicked out of
the port. Hold it there. We're at 5 after the hour.
Yeah.
Be back in a couple of minutes. My guest this morning, Tony Ortega, the intricacies of Scientology. You know, this would make one hell of a miniseries. You're on the other side of midnight, and we shall return.
Somewhere there's a stolen halo. I used to watch her wear it well. Everything would shine wherever she would go. But looking at her now, you'd never tell.
Chewing on a piece of grass, walking down the road. This sure does sound like Ventura Highway to me. Welcome back, everyone, to the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, Tony Ortega, we're discussing the weirdness of Scientology. Again, I can't understand why everyone is focused on such a tiny group. What have they done to leverage history, politics? Is it the celebrity side, or is it the fact that they figured out that if they hired enough private investigators and infiltrated enough government bureaucracies, they could actually take over in some sense? Is that what Project Snow White was?
Well, actually, it was more that Hubbard was tired of having to leave ports because the local governments would start looking into them. And what he decided was that the problem for them in places like Greece and Portugal was that the United States and British governments were supplying the locals with documents about them. And so he wrote up this program he called the Snow White Program, where he asked his spies to go into every federal government office on Earth and try to get those documents and try to neutralize them. And so that's what they did from 1974 to 1977, is he had these spies in places like Washington, D.C., so they could get into these offices, burglarize those offices, steal these documents, hoping to somehow that somehow would help you know, give Scientology a break. I don't know. But all it ended up doing was the FBI finally caught on to them. And that story's never really been told. I interviewed the actual FBI agent who finally captured these guys and figured out what they were doing. Her name was Christine Hansen. She's one of the first women FBI agents in history. And I was so thrilled to get her on the phone and ask her about her story. She said no reporter had ever asked her about how she had solved that mystery. And so that's one of the chapters in my book, is how Christine Hansen single-handedly unraveled this mystery and discovered that it was Church of Scientology that was burglarizing these offices and why. So that was it's just a fascinating part of Scientology history. And it's actually I think it's kind of amazing that Scientology survived it, because ultimately 11.
See, again, this is what I don't get. You got a penny ante group playing thug, playing mafia, and they're allowed to get away with it for decade after decade. And they've got SARS and celebrities and money. And it's like there's something else here that we're missing.
I think it's the religious cloaking. I think that it's particularly in the United States, where people are very squeamish about talking about religion. One of L. Ron Hubbard's brilliant insights was that when he stopped talking about it as a science and started talking about the Church of Scientology, and they started talking about religious freedom, it really made it very difficult for governments and plaintiffs to get any access to them and get sort of recompense for what they were doing to people. And it Larry Wright talks about that in the movie Going Clear, that the First Amendment religious protections of the U.S. Constitution are very powerful, and even though this is a small group, they still have they're still able to get away with amazing things because they call themselves a church, and that gives them
Only that, they were recognized by the IRS as a church.
That's right. They gave them nonprofit status, a tax-exempt status in 1993, something they've been fighting for years. And how they got it was not that the IRS suddenly said, hey, you know what, they have a good argument, let's give it to them. No, they harassed the IRS officers and commissioners for decades until they finally knuckled under. I mean, yes, you're right. It's a small group. It's kind of amazing. But this small group basically brought down the IRS.
Well, again, when small groups – and NASA, by the way, is another small group, and you'd be amazed at the places I was able to get into and the scrapes I was able to get out of by simply showing my NASA badge. So I've been on the trail of unusual things where the groups have much more power than you would think in this society, because they know something. They've got an edge that they can threaten to use, and that's why people back off. And I go back to JPL and, Parsons and Hubbard. We now have on JPL imagery evidence that Hubbard was right. All around us in the solar system tonight, Tony, there's stunning ancient ruins. And my colleagues and I are thinking that if there are ruins out there, there had to be people that lived in them. What happened to all those trillions, literally trillions of people? Could it be possible that you and I and everybody listening did have former lives in that milieu, and somehow Hubbard found out and used it for his own ends?
Well, I'm just not very impressed by Hubbard's actual – I mean, these are great ideas, and you're right. They bring up some fascinating concepts, but I've actually read the materials that they use in these counseling processes. I mean – you're literally going outside and counting the number of people you see, and they charge you hundreds of dollars an hour for that.
Let me get my words straight here. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not defending his process or what he's doing. I'm saying he got the idea because of connections that are now being validated at ways that he could never have imagined they'd be validated. And it's like, human beings do weird things when they get a snippet of something that's valuable, incredibly valuable. Look at the governor of Illinois. What did the governor of Illinois say when Barack Obama was elected? How can I use this Senate seat to basically benefit me? That's what they threw him in federal prison for. So did Hubbard know some things and then simply completely emasculated what he knew because he was subtly focused on himself as opposed to the knowledge base that could actually liberate people?
I would be shocked if Hubbard actually knew anything. I mean, if you just look at the progression of his ideas, this guy was a hypnotist. He was a master hypnotist who was who actually put on shows in the 40s and who found a way to manipulate people. And none of his ideas are checking out. I'm sorry. I mean, there are not implant stations on Mars. There are not freight trains on Venus. And I mean, this always happens is, you know, somebody says, oh, somebody had this idea and somebody had that idea. They're somewhat similar. They must both be right. I'm sorry. It just doesn't work that way. And, you know, you're ascribing things to Hubbard that just don't match with what he knew, what he said, what he wrote. It's a romantic notion. I understand why you're going there, but it just doesn't match if you actually read Hubbard and what he was saying. He was wrong about virtually everything he said about the solar system. So for you to sort of extract something that he said in an abstract way and say, oh, well, he actually was right about this or that. I'm sorry. It's cherry picking. It's confirmation bias, and it just doesn't match with this particular man and what he was about.
Okay. Let's talk about your book. I love the title, The Unbreakable Miss Lovely. Who was Miss Lovely?
That was Scientology's code name for Paulette. So here was this journalist who had written a book exposing Scientology. Yeah,
give us her background. Who was she? Who did she work for? Why did she decide to take on Scientology?
This is part of what we discovered in the book. One of the things that I learned about her when I got to know her was she didn't know how she had survived the Holocaust. Both of her parents were killed at Auschwitz. She was born in Belgium, in Nazi-controlled Belgium, and that was one of the first things we discovered. We found people that had known her parents and were able to discover how she survived that situation. And she was in orphanages in Belgium, and ultimately she was adopted and brought to the United States, brought up by a family in New York. And then she became, you know, she was a beautiful young woman. She was ambitious. She went to college. She became a magazine writer in Manhattan in the 60s. I mean, it was very glamorous. She was just a fascinating, really smart person. And she was just looking for subjects that would get her noticed. And she met a couple of guys that were into Scientology, and she thought this sounded strange. And so she started investigating it. And that's how she got into it. And she realized that, unlike other journalists at the time, because it was getting some coverage, she really focused on the abuse side, that there were people who were leaving Scientology who were afraid for their lives, and she wanted to understand that.
Now, what time frame was this?
Her first magazine story about it came out in December 1969, and the way she knew that her magazine article had come out was that first day, two different men called her up and threatened to kill her. And the harassment just started then. It just never let up for years. She turned her magazine story into a book that came out on June 1st, 1971. It was called The Scandal of Scientology. And Hubbard just marked her for destruction. And she was subject to all these elaborate operations. Like I said previously, she was actually framed for a felony and was facing 15 years in prison. And my book explains for the first time why she was able to get out of that and why the federal government dropped that. And then she was, exonerated with the FBI raid. But they kept running operations against her into the 80s, which I don't think everybody knows about that. A lot of people knew her story, but not these details. And she's just a fascinating person. She survived it all. She's really funny and a lot of fun. And one of the things I think made the book successful was, and I give my publisher credit, he said, don't write it like a news story. Write it as if it's happening. So when you're reading The Unbreakable Miss Lovely, you're reading it, you know, it's kind of like a novel. It's all factual. I based it on court records, interviews. I actually went back and found these people who had gone through these things 45 years ago, and it wasn't just based on what Paulette remembered. And so it's a compelling read. I've gotten some wonderful reviews. And I have an announcement tonight, Richard, that none of my readers are aware of. I was saving it for your show. The audiobook version of The Unbreakable Miss Lovely is now available for pre-order and will be released 1 week from today.
Okay, I think we have a link, I think, on the other side of midnight. Let me go check. If not,
I'll make sure you do.
We will have. Well, that's great. Now, who did the narration?
Me, I did.
Okay, well, I have to ask. So sometimes, you know, other people do these things.
It was an interesting process. It was a lot of work.
I'll bet it was, yes, okay. Oh, yeah, we have all the links there now. And, you know, The Unbreakable Miss Lovely. She looks lovely. Is that really her?
That's really her. She is lovely, and she, that's why they called her that. And they referred to a few different things, but they called her Miss Lovely in their documents. And I mean, they were watching her closely. They had people on her every day marking down. At one point, they actually got an agent, a secret agent, into her apartment and became her roommate for 3 months in 1973 as she was facing indictment. She had no idea that her roommate was reporting everything back to the church.
And she wasn't suspicious?
Only later. And one of the things that we set out to do in this project was to track him down, and we did. He wouldn't talk to me, but we finally confirmed his identity and who he is. And that was one of the things Paulette and I wanted to do, was solve some of these mysteries. And one of the most satisfying things in the project was one of the former spies did come forward as we were working on it and apologize to her for what they had put her through.
We had a very similar situation. I had Tom Carey on a few days ago talking about Roswell and how the people in Roswell, the children of the people who saw interesting things, were basically intimidated by the military and told that they would be murdered. They'd be taken out in the desert and no one would ever find them. The son of one of those agents, decades later, showed up and apologized to one of those witnesses with a thing of flowers, I believe.
Wow.
So, in other words, people are being directed to do things that are against their own character and their own sense of well-being, and when they get out from under it, they become themselves again. So, what is the hold that Scientology has on people?
You know, it's a very powerful thing they're selling. It's certainty. I mean, that's what they get people with, is when you first go to them, they try to find your ruin, is what they say. And what is it that's hurting your life? And for Paul Haggis in the movie Going Clear, he explains it was a bad relationship, a problem in his relationship with a woman. Whatever it is, they find out what it is that's hurting you, and then they tell you, we can solve that. And they said, and it looks very scientific. They have all these check sheets you go through. And to some people, that's really attractive. Oh, all my problems in my life can go away if I just follow these check sheets and take these courses. And that wouldn't appeal to me. I know life doesn't work that way. But to some people, they love the idea that if they follow the rules, join the group, dedicate themselves to it, they will, that everything will be taken care of for them and they will have certainty in their life.
And
that becomes a very powerful idea.
Do you think that's what Tom Cruise really thinks, believes?
Oh, absolutely. He had a terrible childhood because of his father, who basically abandoned him. And he's been a seeker his whole life. Before he joined Scientology, he was at seminary. He was going to become a priest. And I mean, this is a guy that's always sought answers from other people, and he is convinced that David Miscavige, the current leader of Scientology, and Tom Cruise are the two most important human beings on the planet. And the rest of us are deluded fools who don't realize that we're living on a prison planet, and only David Miscavige and Tom Cruise can do something about it. That's the idea he's bought into. And once you buy into an idea like that, everything else just looks ridiculous. The spy who came forward, for example, his name is Len Zinberg. He's a great guy. He was explaining this to me. He's a young guy. He bought into these ideas. Once you buy into the idea that Scientology has all the answers, you don't care if you break laws or if you ruin other lives, because you're dedicated to this larger purpose about the universe. And once you really buy into that idea, it's a very powerful idea. Paul Haggis explained that that's why Scientologists can put up with so much press criticism. They just don't care what the press says, because they feel that being a persecuted group actually strengthens their dedication to it. You see? So it's a very powerful idea that grips people, that they have all the answers, and they call it keeping Scientology working. It's the set of policies that they really have to dedicate themselves to.
By the way, if people want to see what some of these folks look like, you go to theothersideofmidnight.com, go to Radio with Pictures, scroll down under Tony's items. We have the Scientology current leader, David Miscavige, there. Click on that. It makes a bigger picture. And then if you continue to scroll down, there's a book that he's written. What's the content of the book?
Ruthless. You're looking at Ruthless by Ron Miscavige. It's a new book, came out in May. Ron Miscavige is the father of the leader of Scientology. And he was actually in the Sea Org for 25 years. And he literally escaped from Scientology's secretive international management base in California in
what
March.
What do you mean he escaped? Are we talking climbing down a bunch of twisted bedsheets?
He had to run out while the guards weren't looking.
You're kidding.
No, I'm serious. He's a 75-year-old man. And he's now 80, and he's decided to write a book about his experiences. Believe a lot of these narratives by the Mark and Claire Headley, Marty Rathbun, Mike Rinder, they all have to describe how they escaped. You know, and that's why Lawrence Wright called it the prison of belief. You know, and they have these camps, these compounds in various parts of the country, and their largest one is this 500-acre compound in California, near Hemet, California, that they call Int Base. And that's where Ron was living, and he had to escape with his wife, and they eventually ended up in Wisconsin, and he wrote this book. He is now enemy number one as far as David Miscavige and the Church of Scientology is concerned. They run multiple websites that are smearing him. They're doing what they can to try to hurt the reputation of the book, but they can't. I mean, it's a good book. It's a really interesting look at what he went through. And it's particularly interesting to see a father's reflections about his own son becoming this dictatorial leader.
So in this book, he's describing both their lives as Scientologists and what happened to him and what happened to his son.
Yeah, exactly. And it was featured on 2020 in May or late April, I think. And, you know, David Miscavige and the church have done everything they can to...
Again, this fascination for a group that's so tiny.
I know.
Keep scrolling down. There's an incredibly nice picture of Tom Cruise with some lovely lass. Image number 3 under Tony's Items Tonight. And then image number 4 is...
Paulette. That's Paulette and her husband Paul with Leah Remini. And let me just go back and point out the thing about the reason I gave you that picture of Tom Cruise is the tabloids are always printing stories saying that Tom is leaving Scientology. And I don't know who is feeding them these stories because I keep printing photos like this. This is last year's October. They have this every October. They have this big celebration in England. And Tom Cruise is not only there at the celebration, but you can see he's wearing his large Freedom Medal of Valor that he was given in 2004. Tom Cruise is as dedicated to Scientology as he ever was, and he keeps coming to these events. So I just wanted to show that as photographic evidence that these tabloids don't know what they're talking about. And then, yeah, the picture below that is Paulette Cooper with Leah Remini, and I thought that was a unique moment when, you know, a whistleblower of the past is meeting the current whistleblower.
Yeah, well, we can talk about the other whistleblowers after the bottom of the hour. We only got maybe 30 seconds here. It just seems to me, again, I go back to the disproportionate influence and attention we're paying to basically a tiny cult,
right?
So again, what's the hidden mystique? They know how to hire PIs?
Well, and they have a lot of money. They have a lot of money, and they open a lot of real estate around the world, and they have media organizations terrified. They're very good at scaring people.
Now, why would they have media? Because it used to be said that never argue with a company that orders ink by the barrel. So you've got major press, major newspapers, major networks. Why are they scared of Scientology?
I think it's the Time Magazine thing. It had a huge influence. The fact that the Scientology sued for $416 million, and even though they lost that lawsuit and Time was exonerated, it cost Time Magazine $8 million. There are a lot of news organizations today that would not be able to survive taking a blow like that. And so they're very cautious about this subject, particularly to hit television news. They're very worried.
It's interesting, just academically, that you have two institutions pitted against each other, both of which are protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution.
That's true.
We're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, Tony Ortega. 1.5 hour to go. I'll give phone numbers. Remember Facebook and Twitter. You can join the conversation. I've got a bunch of backlog Twitter and Facebook questions I will ask Tony when we come back. And we shall be back right away.
You know a dream is like a river, ever changing as it flows. And a dreamer's just a vessel that must follow where it goes. Trying to learn from what's behind you and never knowing what's...
Mm-hmm.
missing. It's the time that I spend.
And welcome back. 1/2 hour left to go. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us, of course, on Skype, 505-796-8802. 505-796-8802. Or on Skype itself, Enterprise Mission or The Other Side of Midnight. And again, Facebook and Twitter, upper left-hand corner of the homepage. We have some Twitter and Facebook action. Let me ask, these are some intriguing questions. Are you familiar, Tony, with the name Ingo Swann?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay. Question from Voluntary Exchange on Twitter. Were any of Ingo Swann's abilities developed through Scientology?
Well, he was definitely an enthusiastic Scientologist at one time. In fact, I found a document that was I thought was really interesting. In the 70s, they put on a OT summit, they call it. That's where they bring together several of their high-level members to kind of talk about things. And two of the people on the panel were Chick Corea and Ingo Swann. And I thought that was fascinating. I think, though, later, what happens with so many people who are in Scientology is they ultimately become disaffected or move away. And I think the things that you probably know him about were really not – I think he left Scientology at that time. I'm not sure how much he ascribed – he you know, gave credit to Scientology for his other you know, activities that he came up with. So I'm really not sure how to answer that question. I do know, though, that he was a very enthusiastic upper-level Scientologist at one time.
Well, in this clearing process in the E-meter and that kind of technology, is it possible that Ingo used kind of feedback loops? Like, remember when biofeedback was a big rage?
Yeah.
Could he have used those techniques to perfect his own talent? Because I knew Ingo, and he did have talent.
As I said earlier, there have always been people that got into Scientology, left Scientology, kind of came up with their own flavor of it, tried to improve it. They have lots of names for their groups. And I'm sure that he was the kind of person that just sort of borrowed from Hubbard, combined them with other ideas, things that he came up with on his own.
Okay, here's another one. This is from Facebook, from Eric. Tony might have more info about the new Scientology media studio in Hollywood, the very studio where Invasion of the Body Snatchers, an incredible classic, which is kind of what I was hinting at before, was filmed.
It was the KCET studios for many years after its movie days were over.
Yeah, in fact, Sagan did Cosmos from that studio.
I think KCET bought it around 1970, mm-hmm. and then they kind of fell on hard times and they sold it in 2011 to Scientology, and they spent several years renovating it. So they had this big opening this year. And David Miscavige made a lot of elaborate claims about, you know, we're going to reach every smartphone on Earth and we're going to broadcast television. And they, you know, it was another one of these real estate projects where they just get millions from their own members. And now it's just sitting there. They're not doing anything with it. I think a lot of us that have been watching this we're wondering, are they going to get a cable channel or something? And what's Scientology TV going to be like? but they haven't really done that.
maybe like Trump TV.
I won't be surprised, Richard, if November 9th, right, the Trump channel debuts. But so Scientology has this state-of-the-art studio, and we're not sure what they're going to do with it yet.
Okay. Another Facebook question from Bro Southern Mind. I love these names, these acronyms. Anyway, ask your guest to speak on Scientology's Trementina base in the deserts of New Mexico. They're just north of us here. What the hell's going on there? He talks about archived large metal plates with the writings of Hubbard and strange symbols in the ground.
Yeah, there's an entity. Scientology is made up of hundreds of small entities, corporate entities that they created in the 80s. And one of the strangest ones is called the Church of Spiritual Technology, CST, super secretive group within Scientology. And CST's mandate is to dig these underground vaults so they can store Hubbard's writings to last thousands of years. And they literally take his words from his books and lectures, etch them on steel plates, store them in titanium boxes with inert gases, bury them in these bomb-proof vaults. And there are let's see, three in California, the one in Tremontina base in New Mexico, and supposedly they're digging in a new one in Wyoming. Very secretive bases. In Tremontina, the vault is dug into the side of a cliff, and they used to have a house built out in front of it to camouflage it. They've removed that now. And, you know, Scientologists were hit up for donations. Give us a donation so we can. And they were pretty open about it. I put up pages from a magazine story last year that they showed these the incredible expenses they spend on these materials to make Hubbard's stuff last, you know, thousands of years.
Have they transcribed Battlefield Earth to stainless steel?
You know, that's a good question. I think they must have, because they're including everything. Well, the funny thing about it, Richard, is when they were doing this in the 80s, when they were starting to do this, the state of the art was a laser disc. And so one of the things they would show people is, you know, donate thousands of dollars because we've got to put all of Hubbard's stuff on this. Well, in the year 2016, you can put L. Ron Hubbard's entire output of all Scientology writings, fiction, everything on a thumb drive. Right, you don't need to dig a hole in the ground.
No, you can put it on a micro dot and send it to Mars, because NASA's already done that. The Planetary Society has done that with voluminous works, far more than all of Hubbard's writings. So again, it seems to me like this organization is simply out for the organization.
Well, yeah, I mean, they have a mandate to spend money to dig these holes in the ground. They do, and these places are super secret. Now, what I have been revealing on my website over the last couple of weeks is an anonymous person flew a drone over these secret sites with a 4K camera. And I am each week revealing these unprecedented looks at these secret locations. We premiered the video of Int Base 2 weeks
ago. You mean you didn't give us a link so we could have on Radio with Pictures tonight this super secret drone footage?
Oh, man. Well, it's TonyOrtega.org. We just premiered one yesterday of the ranch where he died. Where Hubbard died in Creston. And, you'll have to stay tuned to see the other sites that are coming up over the next
few
weeks.
Well, what we'll do is we'll put up the link and people on Club 19.5 can go in the archive, our own archive, and they can look. Because to me, this is all very, again, it's disproportionate to what it should be. Doesn't that kind of ring your chimes? Doesn't it make you wonder what's going on beneath this facade?
There's a big pile of money, Richard. When you have a big pile of money and some very determined people, they can make a lot of stuff happen.
Okay, but there's an awful lot of people on the planet with a lot of money, and they're not like this organization.
When Hubbard died, he left CST, that particular group that he wanted to archive his works, $600 million.
How do we know that?
I have a court document that says that. Okay. $600 million, and that's in 1986. They've got billions. They've got billions, and they've got leaders that just all they want to do all day is figure out how to make these things happen, and they hire the best. They hire the most expensive firms. They hire, you know, former Justice Department officials. They hire, you know, they spend money like you wouldn't believe.
Wow.
That's what makes the world go round.
Well, yes, spending money. But having billions, they could create their own private space program, Tony. Why aren't they?
Because they travel through space and they're auditing.
Okay. Well, that's a reasonable answer in terms of their model. Okay. If you want to call us, 505-796-8802, 505-796-8802, or Enterprise Mission or The Other Side of Midnight. Let me see. There were some things I wanted. There were a whole bunch of films. Oh, I don't know what I want to get back to. Miss Lovely.
Yes.
How did? Because she got looking at the weird side. We had a kind of a two-part question. Another guy on Facebook wanted to know why they became so authoritarian. Those two questions are kind of mixed together. You say she focused on the weirdness and the negativity and the abuse. What did she find?
Well, she learned about this ethics program. She learned about how people were being disciplined and how Hubbard went after critics and these policies he had written about never defend, always attack. She became the target of that. And she wasn't she wasn't the only one. Journalists that came after her have found all kinds of abuses. Like, you know, the wonderful journalists at the Tampa Bay Times, Joe Childs and Tom Tobin, they revealed a few years ago that from 1982 to 2010, Scientology was forcing young women who got pregnant in the Sea Org to have abortions.
So that's true.
Oh, yeah. No, Scientology admitted that they, Tommy Davis on camera said they have a policy where you cannot have a child in the Sea Org. And then all these women came forward and said, yeah, and if you do get pregnant, they personally drive you down to the clinic and force you to have an abortion. In fact, there's a fascinating lawsuit going on in Los Angeles right now involving a woman named Laura DiCrescenzo, who she joined the Sea Org. She signed the billion-year contract to join the Sea Org at 12 years old and was immediately working 90 hours a week for pennies an hour. When she turned 13, she was moved to the adult schedule of 112 hours a week. Again, they take home $20 to $40 a week. So it's amazing how Scientology is able to use child labor in this country. And then she was forced to have an abortion at only 17. She was technically still a child herself. She is suing the Church of Scientology, and her lawsuit has taken 7 years to get through the courts in Los Angeles, and she's finally getting closer to there being a trial. This case has already been to the Supreme Court once, and I think it might be going to the Supreme Court again, U.S. Supreme Court. And you know, it's about forced abortion, and it's in Los Angeles. And I'm one of very few reporters who are paying any attention to it, and I'm in New York. The LA Times has still not said one word about this case. It's really fascinating.
Which indicates that Scientology has tremendous influence. Now, you think it's just the money, right? What if it's more than the money? Go back to the philosophy. Go back to, you say Tom Cruise really believes in the fundamental precepts that Hubbard laid down. Imagine if you can inveigle a whole bunch of other people, officials, to basically think the same way. In other words, money to me is not the only coin of the realm. Immortality would be, if you can really maybe show somebody that you might be able to fulfill the promise?
Well, look, L. Ron Hubbard promised all kinds of effects from Scientology, not just, you know, the ability to go through reincarnation and hold on to your memories, but all kinds of superhuman powers. And in 60 years, they've not demonstrated one of these abilities, not one.
Okay. I've got another question from one of our old listeners, Tim, who actually, Tim, you've been reading my mind because Tom Cruise starred in a very amazing film called Eyes Wide Shut with Kubrick. Remember that?
Yep.
Then Kubrick got killed. He didn't die naturally. It was a murder. And then the film came out, and it was an incredible revelation on secret societies manipulating government, et cetera, et cetera. And Cruise was up to his eyebrows in it, as well as his wife. What do you think was the bigger picture there?
I think the more interesting question is about Kubrick's daughter, Vivian. She's a Scientologist.
Kubrick's daughter is a Scientologist, okay.
Yeah, and it ripped that family apart, and it broke Kubrick's heart. And I've talked to the family, and they're still upset about it. And he was grooming her to really become a great filmmaker of her own. She'd made a documentary of Full Metal Jacket. She'd done the music for some of his films, and it really broke his heart that she became a Scientologist and broke away from the rest of the family. And it's that to me is a more interesting story. What Scientology does to families, and is actively ripping apart families right now. And there's going to be a couple of TV series coming out soon, including Leah Remini's, that are going to focus on this, about how families really suffer from this organization that demands total loyalty.
So why would her becoming a Scientologist break the family apart? Because why would her religion have anything to do with her talent?
Because she completely dropped the work that she was doing for him. And, you know, he wanted her to do the music, the score for Eyes Wide Shut. And she rejected him because she was too busy with Scientology in Los Angeles.
So it fundamentally affected her entire life.
Absolutely.
So this is not just your average Methodist church. This is more like a life ambition, a life journey, a life commitment. You mentioned a billion-year contract. That's kind of life.
Yeah, well, it demands you know, Scientology's keeping Scientology working policy. You, if you're going to be a Scientologist, you have to buy in that it has all the answers. That you know, they lie and tell people that, oh, you can be a Christian and be a Scientologist, you can be a Jew and be a Scientologist. It's not true. Talk to any former member. Once you've been in for a little while, they start asking you to drop the other practices, they call it. And you have to dedicate yourself entirely to Scientology. And people, if somebody decides they don't want to be part of it anymore or says something bad about it, they get rejected by the group. They're called a suppressive person, an SP. All other active Scientologists who want to remain in good standing with the church must completely cut off all contact with the SP, even if it's your brother, even if it's your mother. And that's why so many families get ripped apart. And that's really the story that's been coming out in the last few years.
So they basically really are the classic cult, which isolates the victim from family, from friends, from outside influences, and then they have whatever they want to do with them.
They demand total obedience, total loyalty. And again, people buy into it because they think, well, Scientology is really giving me all the certainty I need in my life. And as Lawrence Wright explained in the book Going Clear and in the movie, the bars are inside your head. You know, it's a prison of belief. And he really compared it to radical Islam and stuff. I mean, he thinks it's the same mechanism that you buy into a certain worldview and you're able to do the most horrific things in its name.
I could make a comparison, and I won't. Anyway, moving on. If Hubbard started out with Dianetics, regressing people from zygotes forward, and then got the idea, well, let's go beyond zygote, let's go before, did the idea of mixing sexuality and the transfer of life after life after life come up? And how did Scientology, or how does Scientology, view homosexuality, transgender operations, all of that?
Well, you know, there's a really fascinating person named Kate Bornstein that I've become friends with and I wrote about. She was born Al Bornstein and was actually on the ship Apollo with L. Ron Hubbard and was a really dedicated Scientologist, left Scientology, and then became, over years later, one of New York's most well-known transsexual performers as Kate Bornstein. And Kate's wonderful. And she's explained that one of the reasons that drew her to Scientology was that when Hubbard talks about thetans and how you're this immortal being that has lived countless times, that thetan lived lives as both men and women. And so from a transgender perspective, Kate says, this was fantastic. That's exactly how I felt, that I didn't really have any set gender. But on the one hand, you could see Scientology as a really progressive idea that way. The problem is, when L. Ron Hubbard came up with this stuff in the 50s, it was very much a product of its time. And if you read Dianetics, he specifically talks about homosexuality being a perversion.
Oh.
And he comes up with this idea of a tone scale, and that you need to, you need to audit your way up the tone scale to be a better human being. And he put homosexuals down near the bottom. And so it's literally a gay cure, right? If you're homosexual, you're 1.1 on the tone scale. You need to do auditing to raise yourself to 2, 3, 4 and go up the scale. And then, of course, you're no longer a homosexual. So that's the idea baked into Scientology from the very beginning. Yes, you'll find some more progressive areas of Scientology and some missions in places like West Hollywood might be more accepting of homosexuals. But the top brass, the people at Flag Land Base in Clearwater, oh, no way. I mean, this is a very homophobic organization.
Wow. Okay, that's important to put on the record. Let's go to the families. A lot of families, and I guess your writer friend was the first to kind of look at this abuse. How are the families dealing now with Scientology? And I understand there's a phenomenon called disconnection, and there's a real fight about that.
That's right. I mean, as I was describing earlier, once somebody is excommunicated, and in Scientology language, they're declared a suppressive person, everyone else has to cut off contact with them, even if that means splitting up a family. And you see that again and again. So for many years, especially with the press, afraid, people who left Scientology just had to be totally quiet because they were worried that if they said anything, their family would be ripped apart. Well, now the press is less afraid of Scientology, and more people are coming forward and saying, yeah, listen, my family was torn apart. I can't see my daughter. I can't see my, husband. And we have some really interesting stories about that at my website. And like I said, there's a couple of TV series being developed now. I think you'll get to see them early next year, where you're going to get to talk to some of these people who are trying desperately to reconnect with their family members. But as long as they're in Scientology, it's very, very difficult.
So there are basically support groups for ex-Scientologists and family members. And so there's kind of like – because I remember that there were other cults where people would be kidnapped to be deprogrammed. Have people gone that far with Scientology?
There was deprogramming of Scientologists. That was, you're right, that you'll remember that was more of a 1970s thing, right? A 1980s thing, and less of that today. I think the internet has changed that a lot. I think people find a solace by reaching out to each other on the internet. You'll find there are groups on the internet of ex-Scientologists that talk to each other and support each other. There are also therapists. I know an excellent therapist in Los Angeles named Rachel Bernstein, and she spends a lot of time with ex-Scientologists. It's a whammy, man. I mean, Scientologists come out. It takes years to throw off that indoctrination. I mean, it can take – I've talked to people that have been out 12 years and say they're still struggling with trying to get – throw off that Hubbard thinking. Other people come out and they recover from it fairly quickly. But for many people, they really reprogram the whole way you think about the world.
How did Paulette Cooper survive? Did she have help? Did she have any official, did she have any legal counsel? Did she have any media support, or was she all on her own?
All of that happened. She had attorneys who helped her that I talked to. She had help from other journalists. Mainly, she's just a gutsy woman. I mean, she's just really an inspiration.
Well, you can see that in that picture. Look at that picture.
Oh, she's something else. And last year when the book came out, she and I went on a book tour together, and we actually made public appearances, and people loved her. I mean, she's just really something else. One of the things I talk about in the book that didn't, it was kind of counterintuitive, is that for a while she was working for the National Enquirer. And she wasn't writing about Scientology at that time, but her editors knew all about her lawsuits and the fights she was going. So they would find work for her specifically because they wanted her to be able to pay her attorneys. So for many years, the National Enquirer knowingly helped out Paulette Cooper. And she said the editors of the Enquirer just really had no love for Scientology. So I thought that was a fascinating little tidbit.
I was going to say, given the role they played in John Edwards, why haven't they taken on a bigger role in Scientology? Because all the things this organization is doing are illegal, immoral, and obviously they're not being stopped. And that, again, goes back to why.
Well, I give the Enquirer credit in the book, but today the Enquirer, they'll have a story that exposes some secrets of Scientology, because as you point out with Edwards, they do legitimate work. But then the next week they'll have something just totally silly and just preposterous. So they're not very consistent, and I think that's part of why they don't have a better reputation.
And why they don't try to do more on this, because it won't be believed?
Possibly.
Hmm. Okay, we only got a couple of minutes left. Excuse me a second here. We need to plug the book, because to me this book is very important, because not only does it talk about Scientology, but it talks about the courage required to stand against evil.
Paulette, I think, is a very inspirational figure, and I hope before too long an actress wants to play her in a movie maybe someday.
See Helen Mirren in that role?
Oh, young Helen Mirren. Oh,
it's a Helen
goodness.
Mirren role.
Yes, it is. That's a great call. Well, you know who Paulette wants to play her?
No.
Nicole Kidman.
Oh, really? Talk about irony.
Well, how tall is Nicole? She's got to be like 6 feet tall, and Paulette's about 5'1".
Nah, you can fake that, Helen Mirren. It's Helen Mirren.
Name of the book is The Unbreakable Miss Lovely. It's available at Amazon, and 1 week from today, it will be available at audible.com as an audiobook. And my website is tonyortega.org, where we cover Scientology every day, and there's always big news breaking, including these fabulous drone footage videos.
And we do have the link. Turns out we do have the link in Radio with Pictures. M is there again.
We have premiered three sites, Int Base, the CST headquarters, and up in the mountains of Los Angeles. And just yesterday, we premiered video of the Creston Ranch, which was L. Ron Hubbard's final location on the planet.
I want to know what's in the damn archive behind his stuff. Is there other interesting stuff there?
And rumors circulate. People say they keep gold in there. Other people say that the celebrities.
That's not what I'm asking about. I'm asking about real ancient history. Anyway, Tony, I want to thank you so much. This has been very interesting and very insightful. And
a lot of fun.
It kind of organizes my thoughts around what we're going to be experiencing in the next few months. I think maybe we'll hear some things from Scientology. They might even actually raise their voices and say, see, he was right. Anyway. And that kind of proceeds to what we're going to do Saturday morning, which is going to be our extraordinary imaging panel with our team, with Kinthea and all the gang. We're going to show images of an ancient civilization all around us, and we're going to ask the simple question, are in fact we the Martians? Now, one more little tidbit here. Tomorrow morning, I will be off. We're going to be doing a series of guest host kind of discussions and programs, and Mike Spence tomorrow is going to do the job that I'm doing tonight, sitting in this chair, and I'm going to be excited to hear what he does, and I'm going to be excited to hear how he handles what he's going to be handling. So until tomorrow morning, same time, same bat channel, thank you one and all, in 160 countries and more out there, and keep remembering, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.